The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
I think we'll be starting our event now, and I'll start off with some introductions. Let me first welcome people to come and take seats at the table. There's several places that are open. We've put some name cards on people that you shouldn't fill. Impelled to sit next to your name, and if you'd like to come up out of the audience and sit around the table, that would be welcome as well. We're very extremely honored to have this event come off in such great fashion, with so many of you coming out in such a short period of time. We actually just contacted John Barton, sitting to my right, who's a distinguished professor at Stanford Law School and the former chair of the Commission on Intellectual Property Rights, the UK Commission on Intellectual Property Rights, which for many of us in the room is an extremely huge deal. I personally teach that book, the report that came out of that commission, in my course every year, and I know it's a standard tool for training young people in the field that are thinking about intellectual property and development and the many conflicts and interesting issues that come out of that. So it's an extreme honor to have John Barton here. It's an additional honor because this entire event was planned in the last 6 days. Professor Barton agreed on short notice to come out. All of you agreed on short notice to appear. And we have an extremely distinguished panel of discussants around who also agreed on short notice to come and grapple with this very interesting topic. Let me just give a short introduction of what we're here to speak about, and then I think we'll turn it over and I'll give a short outline of kind of how the evening is going to go. I probably have a specific date. In August of 2008, Professor Barton and the CEO of Pfizer wrote a letter to Max Baucus, who they had appeared before some months earlier in a hearing about trade and development, including access to medicines issues. And in that letter, they outlined a few key proposals, the goal of which was to meet Chairman Baucus's injunction to come up with a new way to protect our patents abroad, but also demonstrate flexibility and compassion with respect to public health crises in the developing world. And I think meeting those goals really unifies a lot of the people that are in the room today. The goals of attempting to maintain innovation, to create the next best medicine, and at the same time promote access to those medicines that are available globally. The proposal that the letter from Barton and CEO Chairman Jeff Kindler outlines, I'll just highlight three key components of what was a kind of a five-point plan. The first component is that the letter states that developed world nations would commit themselves to develop detailed mechanisms to ensure that their government pharmaceutical purchasing authorities pay an adequate price to encourage research, and also that as donors, they pay an adequate price to cover an appropriate share of research costs for the purchases of new products of primary value to developing nations. So that's the first component, that richer countries, both as consumers of medicines and as donors who purchase medicines for consumption in developing countries, would pay an adequate price to cover research and development expenses. Second, the letter notes that under WTO world's least developed countries are not required to have patents on pharmaceuticals until 2016. And the letter basically endorses that as a good rule and accepts that as the standard that should be the standard for LDCs. And the third component of the plan is that in middle-income nations, that these nations would protect intellectual property, but the markets would be divided, some say segmented. That the poorer sections in those middle-income countries would get the benefit of low prices, and the wealthier sections would pay a price more aligned with the developed world price. And in some countries, it notes, would need to deregulate their pricing regimes in order to allow this to happen. And those, I'd say, are the core three ideas of the proposal on this one. Now, there's been, at the same time, a parallel discussion in the WHO and in other areas where many of the NGOs in this room and developing country governments are proposing an alternative framework to meet the same goals of promoting access and innovation at the same time. And the three main components of that plan was summarized in a WHO document last year, I believe, 2007, 2008. And in resolution 6121, the WHO adopted a global strategy on public health, innovation, and intellectual property that had three different components. Those components were to explore new incentive mechanisms that delink the cost of research and development from prices, for instance, like prizes. That the WHO should explore and countries should explore the use of patent pools to try to overcome some of the patent barriers to both implementing and researching new drugs. And that there should be exploration of a new research and development treaty that would explore both patent and non-patent means to explore creating incentives for innovation for new cases. So we have there kind of two fairly different approaches to tackling the same problem. And I think that's going to be really the heart of the discussion today, is grappling with those two approaches. We're going to start with Professor Barton explaining some of his ideas. We have to his right Joe Damond, who's the International Trade Vice President for Pfizer, who's been working with Professor Barton on these issues. And then we will have responses from several members of civil society and NGOs working on some of these alternatives, pointing out what some of their responses are to that proposal and also outlining some of the alternative proposals. And after those responses to Professor Barton, we'll open it up for a more open discussion, taking questions from the audience and those around the table. And we also have a open webcast to take questions from those who aren't able. So with that, I'll turn it over to Professor Barton. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you very much indeed for the opportunity to speak here and for setting all this up on very short notice. I am extremely impressed with the job you did in setting it up and the group of people that you've drawn together. You have identified what I regard as three of the key parts of my proposal. I want to talk about those three parts and about one more, and that is about the relationship between all these activities and the USTR and trade agreements. And just, you know, sort of to begin with, the indication sitting there testifying to the Senate Finance Committee and being asked, could you and the chairman and CEO of Pfizer work something out together? I was told by Max Baucus' staff that this is not the kind of thing that often happens in a congressional committee. And so for me, it was a very exciting opportunity. And I took advantage of it to try to put forward something based on my analysis of the situation. And it's an analysis in which I tried to think ahead, because I think one has to think ahead in this field. Let me start with the three issues that you identified. The first one is developed world pricing. We haven't really faced this issue yet, but we're going to need to. Let me just talk about a couple of examples. We are obviously thinking about healthcare reform in this country, and, well, we should. It is abundantly clear to me that as we proceed with healthcare reform, maybe not in the first generation of legislation, but later on, we are inevitably going to be drawn into reimbursement decisions which radically affect the direction in which innovation occurs and the incentives that are going to affect that innovation. Let me give you just one totally off-the-wall example, but it's one that is part of the paper I'm thinking of. Why is it that medical technology has become increasingly expensive, whereas computer technology has become increasingly inexpensive? And I think the answer is almost certainly in the buying structure. We are two more examples where we have seen already significant impacts on research incentives. You look at the Institute of Medicine studies on vaccine development in this country. I'm talking now about childhood vaccines. You will see that we have ended up effectively forcing firms out of business. A number of key vaccines are produced by only one company, which is extremely unfortunate from both a market perspective and a supply security perspective. This is a case in which something over 50%, I'm not sure the precise numbers, something over 50% of the market is a government market. It is obviously one which is concerned with cost. The net result is in fact that we have not made the kinds of changes and developments and improvements in childhood vaccines that we ought to be. Second example, we have not sent the correct incentives for the development of antibiotics. Antibiotics are a wasting asset as bugs evolve. And it is now turning out, we don't have that many in the pipeline. So I simply want to suggest it is abundantly clear that the way we handle our healthcare issues is going to affect incentives for research. It is going to be the tail that wags the dog, so to speak. We have not, I think this is one that's going to be hard for industry to talk about, if only because of antitrust considerations. It's one in which the devil is radically in the details. For example, Great Britain has this nice program, National Institute for Clinical Evaluation, is that right? The way the acronym spells out, has this institute which tries to define the cost effectiveness of medicines. We are certainly going to have programs to try to compare different treatments. I think that's going to be part of most people's proposal of healthcare plans. How do I use those? Are those going to be effective? Are we going to, how are we going to handle that situation? And at least what I have in mind is that in this issue is saying we need somehow to begin that discussion, to begin the debate of how to define healthcare in a way that responds logically to the needs for research. Because otherwise, we're going to see real problems. To take not only the examples I gave you, if you talk to, say, my colleagues at Stanford, like Victor Fuchs, who works heavily on healthcare economics, the key thing that many of those economists say is improved technology drives increased healthcare costs. And it isn't just in drugs, it's also in imaging technologies, diagnostics, a host of areas. This is an issue which we are simply going to have to face somehow. And I think it is very important to do so. I am a little surprised that there hasn't been more debate about this question in the context of contemporary healthcare reform. Second set of questions are really important issues. This isn't an IP problem anymore. We have succeeded wonderfully in getting the level of antiretroviral treatment, say sub-Saharan Africa, from somewhere on the order of 10% of the people who need it 5 years ago, to somewhere on the order of 60% of the people who need it now. There is no question the Doha Declaration, the role of generics, the politics, the sort of debates between the industry and the NGOs, which occurred 10 to 5 years ago, contributed to those responses. I think, however, the big thing that contributed to those responses is the evolution of the Global Fund, AIDS, TB, and malaria, and the evolution of PEPFAR. And I think we have to recognize that at least for some categories of drugs, these are the key funding agencies. It is going to be their politics, and whether or not we're going to support them in times of fiscal crisis, it's going to be their politics that affect whether or not there's going to be a market for new and innovative drugs for at least that category of diseases. But that isn't so dealing with, we need to think more about the buying policies of these institutions and the funding of these institutions. But those aren't the only problems, if I go to the poorest countries. I just took a look on the airplane at a study done by the Medicines for Malaria program. And it shows, and also in another study that was just done in Nigeria, funded by the Gates Foundation. And what does it show? It shows amazingly high percentage of drugs that are counterfeit not in the sense of infringing trademark, but in the sense of not getting the active agent that they're supposed to be, or within the ranges provided, within the ranges stated. These studies also show many situations in which the local healthcare system delivers drugs to patients at many, many times the import price. It takes some form of investment to have the distribution structure and the inventory, all that. But the markups between manufacturer and patient are just absolutely incredible. I guess one more thing that these studies show, which I don't think we even begin to know how to think about, is that the poor pay more. We think of, in the United States, the public health care system is for the poor, and the rest of us who are wealthy can buy drugs that we'll pay more for. Realistically, and of course that's all changing with Medicaid and all that, Medicare, but realistically, in the developing countries, a small number of people get access to the public health system, get access to drugs at low prices. The poor don't have access to that system, and they pay significantly higher prices. This is a problem we're going to have to solve out of here. So it seems to me that for the poor nations, there is an extremely important agenda of how we really improve the access. It certainly involves getting that 60% up to much closer to 100%. That almost certainly is going to require all kinds of things, improve infrastructure and everything like that. But it's a problem we have to deal with, and I think it's time we began thinking about that set of questions. Now, the third set of issues, is the middle-income nations. But first, remember, who are the middle-income nations? India, Brazil, China, I don't know what numbers are in Brazil and China, but I know that in India, the number of extremely poor people is greater than the number of extremely poor people in Sub-Saharan Africa. And the average health care expenditure per person for rural India is less than that in Africa. In other words, we have, and certainly I think rural China is almost certainly the same way, although I don't think we have, at least I certainly don't have access to comparable numbers. And I know that the inequality in a society like Brazil is quite substantial. All right, so in countries like this, you almost certainly have to find some mechanism in which the wealthy do pay prices that provide a certain recovery of the cost of research, and the poor get prices comparable to the effective prices you would like to see in such a whether those are to global public sector institutions or not. One of the things which I think is extremely significant about the letter that Jeff and I signed is Jeff, in essence, is committed to some form of access pricing in middle-income countries. I might add, from the industry's perspective, thinking of the wealthy in these countries now, remember, if the world evolves the way we hope it will, in spite of today's crises, the middle class of China, India, Brazil will be a major world market for pharmaceuticals in the future. If we're going to have anything like the current kind of pharmaceutical industry structure, we'll need to have a patent system for those communities. If we're going to survive as a matter of equity, we're going to need an access system for the poorer people in these communities. How do we do it? Obviously, it is an enormously difficult problem. There is no question that, once again, in many of these countries, the poor pay more for the same reason I described it in poor countries. There is risks of, if I start setting up two categories of drugs, there are obviously risks of drug selling, there are obviously risks of arbitrage, there are obviously risks of corruption. In some countries, there are further risks because the healthcare system sells drugs to patients in order to recover costs that the national healthcare system is not willing to pay. In short, these are enormously complex questions, and complex and difficult. And yet, I think they're essential to work. I think they differ radically from country to country. I think they depend heavily on the politics of different countries. I think there's reasons why in some countries the poor don't have much access to resources, and in other countries the more egalitarian. I think we have to begin thinking very thoughtfully about those questions. So those are the three areas that you absolutely correctly identified. And what has led me to the kind of package that I'm describing here? Now the next question, which you didn't mention, but I think is extremely important, is should this kind of package be put in the context of a WTO agreement? I think there's a lot of ways that you can achieve some of the goals that I'm describing here. Probably they require a lot of thinking first, no question about that. And they're going to require a lot of further steps before anything is ready for prime time. But there are several different fora where you can conceive of doing something. The World Health Organization, you can conceive that maybe these issues can be dealt with independently. Certainly, United States health care reform can think about United States pricing and research incentives in its own context. Each developing country, each middle-income country in its health care system is a different set of issues. So maybe they're right, maybe they don't need to be one. On the other hand, it may be that it will turn out very wise to one at some point. And the length, one of the things which the WTO does provide is a mechanism of linkage and trade-offs to achieve agreements that can't be obtained otherwise. Now, I admit that it isn't clear to me what's happened to the Doha round. It isn't clear to me what's going to happen to the Doha round. What the new administration is going to do about it, what the economic problem is going to do about it. But nevertheless, it is clear that global trade negotiations can play some role in solving problems of this type. They have already dealt with specific sectors in a number of cases, civil aviation, many of the services sectors like telecommunications and banking and so forth. We may also be forced to sector negotiations in the context of dealing with climate change. I'm not quite sure how you begin dealing with something like the global steel industry under climate change without an agreement that isn't going to look a heck of a lot like a WTO sectoral agreement, whether it's reached in the WTO or the climate change negotiations. And I don't know how the cross linkages are going to be worked out, but WTO offers a forum for working out those cross linkages. We, moreover, have seen the WTO responsive 20 years ago, in the early 1980s, to industry concerns, both in the pharmaceutical and the entertainment industry sector, and then as recently as May of 2007, to concerns of those who have some doubts about particular free trade agreements in the context of labor, environmental, and pharmaceutical access issues in free trade agreements. So that this is an area in which there may well be all kinds of bases for discussion and lobbying in the future. It seems to me that given the difficulty in facing the global problem, the possible need for some trade-offs, this is a direction you should be considering along with others.
Joe, do you want to just briefly?
More interested in engaging in the discussion. First, let me just say thank you for inviting me here, and we welcome the opportunity to engage in this discussion. I just wanted to make a couple of big points by introduction. Here, obviously, the industry today, the pharmaceutical industry, which I hear is the underrepresented, is doing a lot with respect to research, but it's not perfect. There are over 100 drugs in the pipeline for HIV/AIDS, for example. There's surprising 82 in the pipeline for something like Alzheimer's. We've got a lot of different companies competing with each other to figure out what the best, which of these drugs are going to work, and conducting clinical trials all over the world to find solutions to some of these health problems and these diseases. It's not perfect, but it is producing product. It is producing innovation, And there is something to it. We do know how the current system works and what it does produce. It is very risky. We have bad years. We have low productivity of late. The science is getting more difficult as we enter more difficult areas like cancer. Although there's about 750 drugs in clinical trials currently for different types of cancers. But it is something that we know basically how it works over time. And there's about $60 billion a year going into it. So I think from the industry perspective, we recognize also that there are still, yes, significant gaps. There are diseases that are under research, although there's, I think, more going on in some tropical disease areas or diseases of the developed world than you might think. Yes, there does need to be thought given, especially to areas where there are significant gaps, and especially where there are significant numbers of people in the developing world who have health issues connected to some of these neglected areas. We very much think that the focus of global work with respect to research should focus on a gap analysis and figuring out what isn't being done and building on the current system, not replacing it. So I don't know that the word alternative is the one that we would see as the way of moving forward, but certainly the idea that the current system of incenting research into new medicines can be improved is one that we do. I would agree with that proposition. Secondly, just to say that it is certainly correct, and I think people are aware that the engine for incentive is the developed country markets, where we get the return for that short period that we are able to get a return. And after about 10 years of regulation, you get about 10 years, 8 to 10 years on the market, after which the product goes generic globally. During that period of time, that return is what incents further investment. And we are going to have to deal with what happens, what might happen to that in the future. It is very clear that Americans currently are sort of, I think the numbers bear this out, bearing a disproportionate share of that burden. You just look at the share of global income, number of patients, et cetera, many number of measures. What isn't true is that, and I've seen this, some people say this, but I think one thing we can also agree on is that we really are generally supportive, strongly supportive of competitive markets for generics. The country which has the most competitive market for generics is this country, where 70% of scripts, almost or approaching 70% of scripts are generic, but where it only accounts for 15% or so of costs. Very unusual in the developed world, where it's generally the opposite in a lot of other countries. We get more than that. But the point is that there are tremendous savings in this country for generics once products go up. And it's less the case in the developing world than you might think, too, and I'm prepared to discuss that, too. But I think I've read some of the literature. I know that a lot of groups in this room are very much interested in advancing competitive market for generic medicine in the developing world. And that's certainly something that we see as actually consistent with the model, that the current model of incentive innovation. It's not antithetical. We can discuss how that works. Finally, on the middle income countries. I agree with John, obviously that was why I was in the letter that wrote to Senator Watkins. This is something that we hope there's more discussion of. It's certainly the case that the largest number of poor people in the world probably reside in these middle-income countries if you add up all the people living on subsistence wages in places like India and China. I was saying to John in one of our discussions that it's not simply a question, segmenting the markets, differentiating if you have to, which you would have to reach patients, pricing is a big part of it. The problem is actually more serious or more complex than that, because the health needs of the 800 million poorest people in India or China are a lot different than the health needs of the richest 50 million. And is it even the same product as big enough? And what is the solution to that? Or what role do companies have to play in meeting the actual health needs of people? Those are all issues that I think we're interested in discussing and figuring out ways of moving forward. So I'll just stop there. Thanks.
Thank you.
So now, from here, we're going to have just a few responses, and then we'll open it up for broader questions. So I think myself and Brooke Baker from Northeastern University have a couple responses on the price discrimination aspect of the proposal. And then Sharon Tree from the National Legislative Association on Prescription Drug Prices and Peter Riggs from the Forum on Democracy and Trade both work on reimbursement issues in the United States, and we'll respond from that side. And then Rohit Malpani and Jamie Love both work extensively on international drug pricing issues. We'll kind of have our final responses, and then we'll have an opportunity for you two to engage them in discussion, and then we'll open it up for a broader discussion. So I'm going to be extremely brief. And okay, I just wanted to add a little bit of data on some of the problematics of price discrimination in developing countries, and especially middle-income countries. As both Joe and John. indicated that one of the things that characterizes middle-income countries is extreme wealth inequality. That you find in India, was John's example, but here South Africa, both some of the poorest people in the world, and then also some of the wealthiest. So I've lived in South Africa for a while, and you know, in almost any middle-income country, you'll find a small group of people living on essentially first world incomes, driving German cars, living in nice houses with air conditioning, etc., and then large amounts of people with extremely low income, living in true third world conditions, even in rural areas, living in traditional housing, etc. And so trying to price discriminate between those two units offers particular problems. Now this is just income distribution in South Africa. You see, you know, something from the fifth decile down, you have basically extreme poverty. And in the top 10% of the population, you have people living on almost the median income of the United States. And the key, I think, is actually between the top 10% and the next decile. Because it's really the top 20% of most of middle-income countries, and in South Africa, I know particularly, who are in the private market. Essentially, the public market is 80% of the population. Those people basically have no health care or they have access to government clinics, and that's about it. They don't have enough private income to afford private health insurance or access the private market for health care. In the top 20% of the population, those people do predominantly access private sector. So in 2000, 18.6% of the population in South Africa had health insurance of some kind. Okay. So the next point, if you just assume that that is essentially a demand curve, that's the demand curve that in a monopoly market is going to be the only restraint on pricing. And this is a demand curve assuming that people are able to pay up to 5% of their income on medicines. And it just charts that up. So if you are a monopoly supplier, you don't have a competition restraining your prices, then just to price maximize, you're going to select a price that maximizes both your units of sale and at the price of the sale. You'll be willing to give up units in order to have a higher price if that price is high enough. And so this is showing, that basically if you're only pricing to the top 10%, you know, your price would be about $1,500 a year. But in order to pick up the next 10%, to price the second decile, you need to lower your price all the way down to 400. So you can charge 3 to 4 times as much money to the top tier as the second decile. And then the problem continues, but if you just assume that your market is the top two deciles. So that creates a real problematic, because if you have 20% of your population in the private sector, so one way to price discriminate would be to charge governments less and charge private sector more. The problem is the profit-maximizing behavior in that unregulated market promotes pricing just to the top 10%. And I say the top 10% here because that's the only number we actually have statistics on. It could be much higher. It could be up to the top 5%, etc. So this is a revenue curve. It shows you at each stage, if you only price to the top 10%, you make, you know, under these numbers, $150 million, etc. If you lower your price so it's affordable to the next 20%, you lose money even though you sell more units. So you double the number of sales, but your revenue actually goes down by about half. So you would exclude, in this model, about half of the private sector market. Your profit-maximizing behavior in a deregulated market would price to a top tier such that those people who are too wealthy to afford to get into the government market but are too poor to actually afford your full prices. And these numbers were in part done in response to a competition complaint in South Africa we worked on, and the numbers pretty much exactly worked like this. The amount that was being charged for AIDS drugs in South Africa after there was a large campaign to lower prices was $1,500 a year, which was pretty much exactly priced to the top 10% of the country. And the generic price was closer to $300 a year, which would have been equivalent to what the next 10% could afford. So the problematics come on how do you get a profit-maximizing country in the private sector to lower its price below a profit-maximizing level to achieve access even in just the private market. And I'll just leave it at that. I think Brooke has some more points to follow up on.
So a couple points Professor Barton actually mentioned, but I'll maybe discuss them in a little more detail. The problem of arbitrage, which is basically when there's a high difference in price between what product is sold for in one market and the price sold in another market, the people who have access to medicine in the lower market have incentives to resell it or to divert it or through corruption for that medicine to go into the rich country. Into the rich market instead. And this segmentation is quite hard to overcome in a country distribution system. It's hard at the borders, but it's harder yet within a country. Customs sometimes helps prevent arbitrage between countries, but it's much harder within the country. And I think, as Professor Barton acknowledges, problems of corruption and inefficiency within the drug distribution systems in many of these countries already. This creates even more incentives. And the resulting product diversion can, of course, impact access to poor people. And I think you mentioned briefly, but I'll probably emphasize a bit more, that this potential for arbitrage is actually an incentive for counterfeits as well. The higher-priced products are attractive for a counterfeit, a true counterfeit, someone who's making a totally fake product, not a substandard medicine, a totally fake product, and representing it as the branded product. So they would try to put a Pfizer label on it to convince people it's a Pfizer product because it would be low cost to produce a high profit itself. So there's lots of incentive to try to break those truly fake drugs. But there's also incentives in this kind of system to have increased counterfeits in the generic market as well. Because if those generic markets, generic products are divertible to the rich country market and with the markup, there's greater incentives for a counterfeiter of a generic to make that without any active ingredients. So this high price differential has multiple problems in terms of both what we call arbitrage and corruption. Something else that you mentioned is that, though I disagree a little bit with the way you framed it, poor people in many developing countries do not access medicines in the public sector because this public sector is terribly inefficient and stocked out. And because there's not enough revenue for the health system, it's often diverted by health workers to a private pharmacy for resale in the private sector. And so poor people end up standing in line at a pharmacy for hours at a time. They get to the window and there's no medicine. And it's probably true that the majority of poor people then have to go to the private sector pharmacy to buy the drugs. I don't see a solution in what you proposed thus far to the situation of poor people who are needing to go to the private sector, where in your system, the prices are going to be much, much higher. What is your access is going to be low. I can't get it to the public sector. It's available at a much higher price. I simply won't get it. And I really don't see a solution right now. I'm a little confused in the proposal overall, whether you're talking about discount pricing that will be of medicine controlled by the single source supplier. Pfizer will have two different colored pills, one for the low price market, one for the high price market. But they will be the single source supplier. But what are you really talking about? Generic competition. And I think the overwhelming evidence is that good quality generic companies from India and China can produce medicines much more cheaply now than big pharma is producing in the global market. That the costs are cheaper. They're under, the two are competing against each other in increasing economies of scale. The Indian generics are winning every time. And I do wonder whether you're talking about a single source of supply, which would mean a higher discount price than would otherwise be available through competition. But then there's also an added danger of single source supply, as you mentioned, with respect to vaccines. Single sources of supply, if there's only one company that's producing, you don't have any redundancy in the system. If a plant gets shut down because of quality control issues, then suddenly you have no source of supply. So an added advantage of robust generic competition is you have multiple suppliers who can, in a sense, fill each other's shoes if and when the supply interruption occurs.
Thank you very much. I'm Peter Riggs. I'm the director of Pharma Democracy and Trade. And I wanted to thank Professor Flynn and Professor Barton for this opportunity. Professor Barton started with his remarks talking about how, as federal health care legislation is considered, that we will be, we will be drawn into a set of reimbursement decisions. And I think that's absolutely the case. But I would remind us that in our federal polity, U.S. states feel they've already been through that. They feel like they've worked out the reimbursement issues, and they have some interesting innovations that my colleague, Representative Sharon Treat, will talk a little bit more about. So from their perspective, looking at the potential of a treaty that deals with reimbursement issues, speaking from the perspective of the U.S. state, their sense is this will be their third attempt to fight off attempts to limit their ability to set reimbursement policy. Third time that they will need to essentially rise to defend their economic role. The first time happened through the domestic courts in cases in Maine, in Florida, in Michigan, cases that were litigated all the way to the Supreme Court. In the Maine case, Pharma lost, and Maine was able to set its reimbursement policies in accordance with the state law that had been passed using due process within the state. We should remember also that this debate occurred in Australia in the early part of this decade, when a subsidiary of Pfizer was outraged and challenged the fact that taxpayer dollars would not, under the federal prescription benefits agreement in Australia, would not be used to cover Viagra. And they fought that decision, and ultimately the committee that set reimbursement policies in Australia decided that the unwillingness of the federal health care program to cover Viagra was not going to lead to some sort of public health emergency down under, and again, Pfizer lost this. So in both the Australia and the U.S., reimbursement decisions taken by national or subnational governments was supported. Lo and behold, 6 months after the Supreme Court case involving Maine, and about 18 months after the case of Viagra in Australia, we found for the first time in a trade agreement signed by the United States, a pharmaceutical chapter to that trade agreement, and it contained language that we might describe as strategically ambiguous. It extended coverage of trade disciplines to all federal health care programs. And we raised the question, well, is Medicaid a federal or a state program? And Sharon and I, with a group of legislators, sat down with colleagues at the Office of the United States Trade Representative. We were very pleased with the reception we had at USTR. We talked them through that. An excellent healthcare staffer from one of the New England states went through a number of the forms and the waivers and said, well, what about this? Does this sound like state or federal? Where do we draw the line here? And USTR heard that argument. And we're very grateful to note that in the text of a subsequent agreement, the U.S.-Korea agreement, there was a specific footnote that carved state reimbursement policy out of the scope of that trade agreement's disciplines. So we appreciate that USTR thought about this issue, thought there was room for further clarification. States had expressed an interest in reimbursement policy and defending their right to set reimbursement policies. And lo and behold, in a subsequent trade text, the language was clarified that Medicaid is in fact a state program with the state reimbursement rules will prevail. So that was a success. It clarified that states were carved out. So just to conclude, I think it's relatively easy to understand why states would be nervous about this. Legislators would ask, well, wait a minute. We spent a lot of time in previous sessions thinking about reimbursement policy. Don't we have that power? Attorney generals are saying, gosh, you know, we litigated this case. We litigated reimbursement policy all the way to the Supreme Court. Why are we revisiting this now? State Medicaid directors are saying, didn't we achieve a clarification in the U.S.-Korea agreement on reimbursement? So what's this treaty proposal? So there's a lot of uncertainty, and I think it's fair to say from a state perspective, they would find, states would find a challenge to their reimbursement authority to be totally unacceptable.
Good evening. I'm Sharon Treat. I'm a state representative, formerly a senator, and from the state of Maine, perhaps not coincidentally, given what you've just heard from Peter Riggs. And I thought I would give a little bit, it's great to be here out of the snow, by the way. It was snowing heavily early this morning as I drove to the airport. But I thought I would give kind of a real life perspective. As a state policymaker, we're sort of in the weeds down there. We're not like these federal folks, okay? We are down there trying to balance budgets at a micro level. And in that budget, our Medicaid program is at least a third, you know, the whole healthcare focus is about a third of what we do, and the other big third is education. Medicaid is a state-federal program that is jointly administered and funded, but with a good chunk of the funding, almost half, coming from the states. And I would just mention that in addition to Medicaid, which provides for a very robust pharmacy benefit, states also run a variety of other health programs that involve pharmaceuticals. We talk about immunizations and vaccines, reproductive health and HIV clinics, standalone prescription drug programs that try to reach people who do not have health insurance and do not qualify for Medicaid, which unfortunately is a very large group of people right now because we don't have an adequate health care system. And I think that in trying to do that, well, I guess I would just say that right now I think the states are the healthcare safety net in this country. We are the people who are providing healthcare. And you know, and it's a dwindling, you know, aside from employers, and that's a dwindling number as we see GM and everybody, you know, shedding the healthcare, and understandably so, it's devolving on state governments and our funding source, which currently is in a free fall. And I'll just give you, it's a very simplistic example, but if your budget was based on buying new cars, which is in fact what many state budgets are based on, the sales tax from buying new cars, right now you would not be in a good situation. So that might just kind of a practical example of that. So in trying to manage these somewhat limited dollars and yet provide access to health care to people who don't have it, states have relied on something called the preferred drug list, which is a way of negotiating rebates and discounts with drug manufacturers to get a lower price so that they can provide more medications to more people at a price that they can afford. And when we hear and see in trade agreements, policies about reimbursement policies, trying to prevent reference pricing, which might be another way of talking about this, we get quite concerned and worried, because this is basically the only tool we have is encouraging more use of generics and trying to negotiate down a price. And it's a substantially different price than what is paid under the Medicare program. And there have been some recent reports that came out that essentially have shown that in the Medicare program, where it's private companies doing the negotiation and not particularly well, the actual cost of the health care for many of these seniors has not actually been reduced very much. So there's some real significant differences there, and states have been extremely successful. In fact, many states, my own included, have essentially a flat pharmacy pricing structure in terms of inflation over the last few years, because we've done such a good job managing it and negotiating, whereas in general, the inflation rate in healthcare generally is in the double digits. So for us looking at this, when I look at this proposal, and again, it's in the letter, so the new, I'm going to see all the nuances there, but it comes to me that it's about delaying generics or reducing the inflow of cheaper generics and limiting the pricing approaches that we have that reduce the cost. And so, although Maine is not a third world country, certainly, but we're a rural poor state, and it's difficult for me to see jacking up the prices that we already think are too high, and we have millions of people in states in this country that do not have access right now to prescription drugs, in order to fund the research and development. And let me add that I'm from a state, along with several others, that has been collecting data on how much money is spent on marketing and direct-to-consumer ads for things like Botox and Viagra. And these are not things that are essential medicines. And this is money that is a lot of money that could be spent on research and development, in our view. So I guess I would really encourage those of you who are at this high level, this international level, we're down in the weeds, you're at this international level, to think about a different approach to coming up with research and development and R&D, and think about, is there a way of disconnecting this from this whole pricing structure? And I think that you would find states eager to engage with you. We have our own trade commission, along with a number of other states, where we are very focused on how international trade agreements affect our state, both positively and negatively, and we would be interested in working with you on it. But what I see here makes us extremely nervous, because we don't see how we could continue to provide access to health care in the future when we're struggling even now.
I'll try to keep my comments brief, because I think it's important to hear from people in the crowd. I work for Oxfam. It's a development and humanitarian agency. And I guess I try to talk about 3 points. The first is, we made a decision not to attend the consultation that's being held tomorrow as sort of a follow-up to this. And I think a lot of that comes from the fact that there's really a couple of critical elements that are missing from tomorrow. And primarily, I have to say, it has to do with how they've kind of come about with principles. I think there's a core tenet to a lot of civil society organizations, and that's participation. And that's actually talking to the countries or even to the civil society organizations in the countries where you're looking to sort of create solutions. And I think a lot of the comments that we heard from both, Pfizer and Professor Barton, were sort of about how we're actually going to deal with some of the access issues in developing countries. But what really has struck me about sort of all the comments is there's really nothing in the comments about how exactly they've consulted with developing countries, perhaps, and looking at these issues and tackling them. And so I think it's very problematic to come out with a set of principles up front when you don't really have an idea as to sort of how this would work in developing countries. And I think Sean showed some figures and really showing whether or not you've sort of stress-tested this with different developing countries or really thought about what the implications are. And part of that also comes from the fact that I think, you know, in sort of contrasting this process with the WHO process, that the part of skepticism for civil society groups is that there's form shifting occurring here, which is that there are other sort of parallel processes that are occurring that we think do represent the interests of developing countries and developed countries and do provide an avenue for the pharmaceutical industry, for instance, at the WHO, to lobby as much as civil society groups do. And we think that that's created a very good deliberative process and some outcomes that I think sort of represent a broad base of views. So I think the concern then becomes that we're sort of shifting away from a very, you know, sort of a process in which a lot of contributions are coming together to one in which we really are sort of shoving down the throat of developing countries sort of the ideas of maybe one or two companies and potentially, you know, one or two other thinkers in this area. And, you know, the TRIPS agreement itself is sort of representative of this. I always am reminded of an advertisement I saw in The Economist where a few pharmaceutical companies were very proud of getting the TRIPS agreement passed. The TRIPS agreement itself was developed, you know, behind closed doors, as was most of the WTO. And I think, you know, part of the concern is that this sort of is reminiscent of that process. I was too young to be sort of involved in that back then. But I think in reading the history of trade, this is very similar. And I think that's so part of what has to come, I think, from this process is dispelling some of the skepticism that civil society groups would have around this. Two other quick points. One is around this issue of access to healthcare. It is an important issue. But part of what I'm struggling with is why this process actually relates to most of the concerns around access to healthcare in developing countries. This is something which Oxfam works on very broadly, but when we diagnose this in developing countries, it's really about, you know, funding. It's about donors not living up to their commitments, regardless of, you know, how much money the Global Fund has given over the last few years. It's about developing countries not spending enough of their budgets. But it's definitely a combination of the two. It's about not having harmonized healthcare systems. It's about excessive privatization. There's a whole variety of issues that need to come together. And the concern here is that all of a sudden we're talking about what is a very broad issue and a very broad concern through a very strange lens. And I think it sort of maybe makes people think that they're actually dealing with a problem that really isn't going to be sort of addressed through this process. And I thought it was curious that, you know, you were sort of saying that, well, one of the big concessions from Pfizer was that it was going to guarantee health care for middle-income markets or developing country markets or sort of the poorest in the developing world. And then you sort of contrasted that with the fact that we've been able to deal with the situation around antiretroviral medicines. But actually what we're seeing in civil society groups and in general even at the Global Fund is that there's actually a new crisis around antiretroviral medicines today with newer first and second line medicines. And pharmaceutical companies have actually said that they're taking care of this and that they have their own pricing mechanisms and that they're trying to structure it in a way that won't create these problems over the long run. So the irony is that the very process that you're sort of professing or that you would like to institute for a broad range of medicines is actually already showing to be failing at this point with antiretrovirals, which is why maybe Jamie will talk about some of the other proposals that are coming forward to actually deal with these problems with actually sustaining healthcare over the long run. And before I go to my third point, you know, you talk about the needs of developing countries are very different than developed countries or the poorest, but in our experience, it's actually that they're merging and that, you know, the needs of the poorest, whether they're middle income or the poorest countries, are actually very similar, especially for non-communicable diseases. So it's very important not to lose sight of that and to start sort of trying to create alternative solutions when, in fact, even in middle-income countries, you have to look at it sort of holistically. And the third thing I just want to say is this, which is that the IP issues are not resolved. And I think that's it's a very, very strange statement to say that this is not actually an ongoing concern and sort of shoving that off to the side. And Pfizer is a classic example of not being able to resolve intellectual property issues or being able to deal responsibly with these issues in developing countries. And the Philippines, over the last few years, Pfizer's engaged in very heated litigation as well as very heated lobbying of the government around its decision to try to control their healthcare costs for cardiovascular disease. So I think, you know, when you decide to sort of engage in a process to deal with pricing and sort of separating it out from intellectual property, you're making it very difficult, I think, for civil society groups or potentially for developing countries to imagine how they can actually come to a grand bargain or a good faith agreement when pharmaceutical companies until now have not dealt responsibly around issues of intellectual property in developing countries. So I think it's important not to separate that. And we could talk about other examples, whether it's in Thailand or even potentially with free trade agreements, where the issue actually wasn't resolved at the World Trade Organization, but it was actually, you know, in the House of Representatives and in Congress. And again, that goes back to my first point, which is I think companies have sort of hit a brick wall on some of these intellectual property mechanisms over the last 18 to 24 months. And I think in some way that's why they're sort of shifting to issues around pricing, for instance, because I think developing countries are finally being a bit more assertive around, you know, using TRIPS flexibilities and of ensuring that they can protect public health. So I think shifting it to pricing is sort of a clever way of not having to deal with the fact that developing countries do have the autonomy to guarantee generic competition. And at the end of the day, as I think other people were saying, it is generic competition that is going to ensure that medicines can reach the poorest. And we're sort of creating new problems instead of actually having identified a solution, at least to that one problem in terms of affordability, while not dealing with the others, such as expanding healthcare and ensuring greater financing.
My name is Jamie Love. I work for Knowledge Ecology International. I think we're listed in some things as sort of co-organizing that, but I'd have to say that this was really Sean's idea, and wouldn't have happened without Sean. But Sean, but I think also Molly actually did a lot of work in this too as well. But I think it's really great that John, Professor Barton, and Mr. Diamond are here to talk about this proposal. This is a tough group, and this is I'm sure you knew coming in that you know people are going to not be completely in agreement with you. I will say that in terms of our organization. I think we've worked on these issues in the international level longer than anybody in this room. And Judith Rios, who works with us and has played an enormous role in the WHO negotiations in terms of the global strategy that has, I think, played a hugely important role. And actually approached Professor Barton and asked if we could attend the meeting tomorrow. And I think the answer was no. So we're here. We're glad that you're here. But we echo and share some of the things that Rohit said, which is that we were kind of appalled at the idea that the discussion tomorrow was deliberately excluding certain voices. I think that the developing country participation is quite important, but also a lot of the people that have worked on a lot of the trade issues, including Sean and other people that have worked on some of the things, I think you would have benefited from having had the conversation. And the reason I say that, in part, is... And listening to you talk tonight, I have to say, because I work probably 70% of my time in pharmaceuticals for the last 19 years in the public health area, and so I've heard a lot of these things talked about before. And you were like a laser beam for the pharma, John, Professor Barton. You were like a laser beam for the pharma talking points on sort of analysis of the problem. I mean. Sort of highlighting, even the sources, the Gates Foundation MMV discussion on counterfeits, the problems of the markups in the distribution chain, the fact that it's not just prices, it's all these other problems and stuff like that. It's not so much that none of those things are true. It just sort of reflects kind of like an incomplete analysis of what it might have been if you had more face time with other people that maybe aren't working that closely with Big Pharma or that committed to the interest of Big Pharma. You would have sort of, a different sort of picture might have emerged and maybe different solutions would have emerged. And I think that in the conversation, if the conversation doesn't really talk to the people that are really doing the heavy lifting and have the most expertise in this area and have, frankly, the most credibility in terms of solving problems in this area, I just don't think you can roll us on this. Now, I'll go over just a few factoids and things just in terms of data. Sean did, I think, a good job of talking about the issue of the in-country problems of price discrimination. Anyone that's looked at country things realizes all the problems it is in trying to manage that situation, and Burke did a good job of explaining it, too. There's other problems like AIDS drugs. If you look, we did analysis with the WHO a couple years ago. If you look at the AIDS drugs that were purchased by Brazil as a generic product, which were drugs that were invented before 1996, when Brazil changed its patent law, you were able to buy on a delivered formulated basis, on a per kilo basis, per kilo of active ingredient, a price that was about an order of magnitude lower than the prices people were paying for products that were invented after 1996, even though both products in many countries were generics. Why was that? Well, it was because Brazil made the market for generic APIs, because it was a big market. It was a country that did it, and it took a while. When they first started working, they were paying $25,000 to $20,000 per kilo for 3TC on a formulated basis. You can now buy a completely formulated AIDS cocktail of the first generation drugs for under $300 a kilo. I mean, prices have really gone through, but it took a while for the prices to come down. And it takes a while for you to find sources and competition development, things like that. If you take the middle income countries out of the market, there just isn't enough market in the countries with under $1,000 per capita to really make up the difference. And so that's why there's so much concern among the public health people about the middle-income countries, because they know from experience. Here's another thing that we run across. Some countries want to do compulsory licenses because they just want to, like, get some, you know, they just want to break the ice. Well, one of the interesting problems is, outside of AIDS, they have a hard time finding candidates for compulsory license for two reasons. One, there are not many important drugs outside of AIDS that have been developed in the last decade or so, because it's such a crappy pipeline from Big Pharma. You talk about the $60 billion you're spending on research. It costs you $500 billion to get that $60 billion in higher prices. And you get such a pathetic number of drugs that are really, really medically important that some countries, you know, they have a hard time getting past six in terms of, you know, products outside of AIDS that would do compulsory license. That's kind of a secret we don't like to talk about, because we can't want to talk about how important compulsory licenses are. But sometimes it's hard to find good new drugs that are medically important. But that's about just the inefficiencies of the current R&D system. The other thing that's important is they can't find suppliers. They can't find suppliers because, they're newer drugs, and, you know, if they can't find a drug, Thailand can't go out and become the first market for a generic cancer drug. They're too small. It's like 70 million people. Honduras certainly can't do it. I mean, Chile can't do it. I mean, those countries are way too small. It takes a big country to be a first mover on a generic. If you take Brazil out of the picture, you take India out of the picture, and that's kind of what you're talking about. Well, who's going to be the first mover? And when you don't have a first mover, you have all kinds of pricing problems. Now, the counterfeit. There was a bunch of news lately, this week, about seizures by the Dutch customs authorities about products that were en route from India to Latin America. It turns out it's actually bigger than anyone thought, because we now got a list of about 20 seizures. First it was one, and then it was four, and now it's about 20. One of them we looked at, the products were designed for Peru, were like going to sell at half the price from the Indian company to the incumbent company, and they're both off patent. But, you know, they were cheaper. What was happening is that Pfizer's been involved in this, and several other companies. They've been suing in the Netherlands when the products hit the ground, so they can, you know, they can get the customs to seize and destroy the things in the Netherlands to make it really hard to kind of ship them and kind of drive their costs up. All of these things are really making people angry, and, you know, it just sort of creates, like, the wrong environment to say, just trust us, because we're going to do really good things for poor people, and we're going to, like, you know, if you just, you know, like, back us up and get the USDR to go to bat for us, we're going to, like, you know, we're going to have a really, we're all about sensitivity and analysis and stuff. You know, the case in the Philippines, that was a Pfizer case. They actually sued in his personal capacity, the head of the regulatory authority, wanted to take away his house, basically. That was the size of the judgment. And what was his infraction? He wanted to allow the Philippine regulatory authority to test whether or not a Pfizer product sold in Thailand, which was exactly the same product that was being sold in the Philippines for 10 times as much, whether or not it was medically the same, so that when the patent expired, they could import it as parallel trade. And for that, they basically wanted to take a guy's house away. And that wasn't that long ago. So these things, like, they breed mistrust. And if you don't know about that mistrust, if you don't know these little anecdotes and these stories, then you're, like, thinking, like, oh, wow, this is a great idea. I mean, these guys I met at a cocktail party, they said they're really nice people, and they know all about Africa, and they're, you know, they have a lot of good statistics, and we can really trust them. Well, we don't really trust them because we've just seen too many of these things, and I don't think you should trust them that much. I think you should, you know, you should talk to people in their kind of their trenches a bit more and understand. Now, what are the alternatives? Well, some people think that price discrimination is hard to manage. Europe has this problem. Eastern Europe, Northern Europe. Order of magnitude difference in prices between Eastern Europe, New Europe, and Northern Europe. Okay, so then they want to have a single market in Europe. Highly problematic in terms of cancer drugs and severe illnesses, the prices. And then you've got a situation where, well, okay, even if you don't have parallel trade, which they do in Europe, but even if you didn't have that, you have reference pricing. So you have the Dutch looking at what the Spanish charging, and the Spanish charging what Brazil's charging, Brazil looking at what Africa's charging. You have those kind of problems. And you can tell people, put blinders over your eyes, don't read the newspaper, you know, forget about it. But, you know, not everyone really completely trusts that that will be the outcome. So, you have the in-country thing that Burke talked about. You have the cross-border thing. You have all this mania about, you know, how many different colors you need if you have different countries in Latin America, you know, and, you know, like you have to take lie detector. I mean, it's just really expensive to manage that kind of thing. So, the problem you've got is people have different incomes, countries have different incomes, different capacity to pay. So the solution people are pointing to that's reflected in the global strategy that the WHO embraced is to start moving towards separating the R&D incentive from the price of the product. Stop trying to be a policeman on, you know, like, you know, every product sale. Sort of get to the idea that, like, yeah, it costs money to develop drugs. You need to have money as a financial reward. Rich countries should pay more than poor countries. Middle countries should pay more than poorer countries. Everyone should pay something. But instead of trying to tie it to the drug, do some other thing. So the Bolivia-Barbados proposals, which I think you should be looking at, for example, in some, like one on cancer, they said that the country should look at their cancer budget and say what fraction of their cancer budget should be a reward for innovation. That's what Thailand wants to do. It's actually part of their plan to actually look at this now. So they want to say, if we spend X on cancer, maybe some part of our budget should reward people who develop cancer drugs. And then for doing that, we should get all the cancer drugs at generic prices. We want to demonopolize the generic sector, I mean the cancer sector, but we will pay, and let's have a conversation about what fraction goes to pay for innovation. And they said the same thing on the AIDS drug, that some part of PEPFAR or the global fund should go to people for innovation, but then they should get everything at generic drugs. Right now you got drugs that cost $100 for a cocktail and cocktails that cost $4,000. And it just depends on a licensing decision. I mean, it's crazy. And you can't move 3.5 million people, 99% are using the 100 cocktail, and they're going to burn through it in 7 years, to the $500 cocktail or the $1,500 cocktail. It can't happen. In fact, I'll tell you how you got the Global Fund, because, you know, we had a conversation with Mitch Daniels about it right after it happened. He was the head of OMB for Bush. And I was involved in this because I personally negotiated the CIPLA deal in 2001, got the price down to $1 a day. Before that, it was probably the cheapest cocktail. It was probably about $1,100. And 2 years before, it was $10,000. So it got down to $1 a day. Mitch Daniels said at $1,000 a year, it was cost-effective. It was not cost-effective to treat AIDS people, patients with AIDS in Africa. He said at $1 a day, he felt it was morally compelling to provide treatment. So for him, like, driving the price down through generics made the U.S. want to become a donor. High prices meant built bridges or something like that. You know, like, it's too expensive to save lives at high prices. Now we're moving back to the high prices again. So what's going to happen to the donor support? It's going to erode. It's going to erode at the high prices. It'll be there if the prices are low. So there's a conflict. The donors want bang for buck, but the drug developers need some kind of reward. So what the Bolivia-Barbados proposal, there's five of them. One of them says, negotiate, the drug company should negotiate what fraction of the PEPFAR budget and the Global Fund budget goes to for R&D dividend, and then make that money aside and only give it to people who license their patents to the Unitaid patent pool. So basically, if you give up your monopoly voluntarily, then you get some of the money that's set aside in a prize fund to reward people, you know, for the R&D thing. And if you don't, you don't. So I think that those are the kind of things a lot of us have been pushing, R&D treaty, you know, Sean summarized it, you know, patent pools, prizes and delinking R&D incentives and prices. And that's the direction that we really think we can go on right now. This is like going to be a big moment. And we, John, we want you to switch sides. We want you to start working on our side.
Thank you very much. And I think, you know, just getting through that big round of incredible comments, we should have a quick round of applause. This is a particularly contentious and emotional issue for a lot of people, and I want to thank all the commentators for keeping their cool and making this a very constructive debate. So let's turn it over to one or both of the panelists to kind of respond, and then we'll take broader questions and move on to that.
You want to say something? Okay, obviously, thank you very much. You've given me plenty to think about and plenty to respond to. I think I just want to make three or four points. The first point goes to this whole question of what kind of command goes in. Is this on? No? What kind of command goes in there? And so I remember the paper by Lakeshire and Jayshree Martel that was used in the debates of dual price, global dual price, and what about 10 years ago, they thought them. And the discussion of cake demand curves. And they showed essentially this problem, that when I have a South African kind of system, obviously the market, if I treat a pure market system, the market court says, put a high price, serve the wealthiest, ignore the rest of the people. And if I'm going to get past that, I have to find some mechanism for getting the government involved. I have to find some kind of public health process. Needless to say, as has been abundantly clear from everybody's discussion, public health systems in many nations are a shambles. Dealing with this set of issues is really going to require some dealing with those public health systems. This is what makes it so complicated and so difficult. I guess the second kind of point I'd like to make is to thank you for the point about Medicare. And of course, I'm sitting here wondering what's happened to the California budget and whether or not they made it through. In what sounded this morning like the most incredibly bizarre package deal I've ever heard of. But I must say, I like the idea of open primaries. So I think it might help. That's a side note. But clearly, Medicaid is just a big issue there. But I think what you're showing is the pressures which, you know, Medicaid is what, 20 to 30% of national drug sales? It's, you know, I don't know, somewhere in that order. Medicare is, you know, probably 40 to 50%, somewhere in that order. And if we have health care reform, some kind of Medicare fine will probably be, you know, 60 or 70%. And the same incentives are going to be applying there. The same set of issues when we have higher budget questions. In other words, we do have a problem that as we turn to more public support, there are going to be pressures on prices. I know we might argue about this. I'm sure sometimes those pressures are justified. But sometimes those pressures can go too far. And we do have to do the thinking about how we keep the pressures from going too far. And I guess you and I, James, have argued about this point in Bellagio 18 months ago, 13 months ago, thereabouts, about, you know, what kinds of systems make sense. Obviously, we clearly are going to have a significant portion of the drugs for the poorest people of the United States and for the poorest people of the developing world produced at a low cost. Somebody has to, they're going to have to produce them, you know, produce them distributed at low cost. There's going to have to be some kind of mechanism to provide funding for research. I'm tending, in what I think is a conservative sense, to see, is there a way that we can keep doing this and adapt the patent system? There's certainly the obvious alternative of going to much more public sector focus. But public sector focus, pretty obviously, has a number of limitations. It has fewer decision makers, meaning less benefits of diversity. It has greater risk of ups and downs depending on what's the topic du jour. And it certainly has risks of corruption as well. And I think we can see the problems with public sector funding of research when we look at the United States defense industry. Somehow we are going to need a public sector reform. And I think what all of us are struggling with is a way to find the appropriate mix of public and private sector funding in a global context, because it is a global context now, and in a way that brings as much help to our generation and future generations as possible.
Thanks. And thanks again for having me. I'm tempted to walk through all the presentations and and respond. I think I would more people, and then I would be viewed as one of the nice people from our industry either. So I won't do that. I'll try to deal with a few key issues. There should be questions on paper. I just want to say right off the bat, I think it is tremendously valuable to try to deal systematically with some of the issues that have been raised, some of the things that have been said about what our sector is doing, what it's done, what some of these cases represent, because either, it's either a very careful selection of anecdotes, and in those cases, often a misrepresentation, and it's just too difficult to get into here. But I think it's definitely worth discussing a lot further the history of some of these issues. I want to talk a little bit about the issue of monopoly, and just point out that, because there's been so much research, and because there's been some success anyway in developing new products, there's a lot less monopoly in a lot of areas than there was before. There's 22 antiretrovirals on the market now, which is a lot more than there was 20 years ago, which means you don't have a total monopoly. I mean, there are some treatments, obviously, that are unique, but in addition, the early retrovirals are going to be going off patent soon. The proposition here, as I said, is that we spend 10 years developing a drug, we get another 10 years to reap the benefit, and then all mankind basically has that medicine forever. For next to nothing, if we can get generic markets to work properly, which I agree with, they should. The issue is what to do about financing during that period of time, and some adequate return during that relatively brief period of time, 10 years, during which the pharma companies get a return on their research and investment. I would also say, again, this is why we have to have a dialogue about some of these issues. Either our pipeline is crappy, which means that soon all the products are going to be generic because there's no new ones coming on and the patents are going to be expiring, or we're so incredibly productive and there's all these new products coming on the market, in which case we have to deal with how to get pricing, how to get access to it before we. But so either we're tremendously successful at innovating, or if we're bad, in 10 years this problem is going to disappear. To put it that way, but or maybe it's somewhere in between. But I just want to say that I've heard both arguments, from people at different times. With respect to the free trade agreements, I just want to say maybe we need this item off the table. I worked on the Australian free trade agreement. I also worked on the Korean. We never, ever intended to have Medicaid or Medicare brought in under those agreements whatsoever. I'll stipulate here. I'll put it in writing. I'll get the CEO to do it. We don't want trade agreements to cover U.S. government programs. We think the U.S. system is fundamentally different than the systems in these other countries. I can go into great detail about why that is. Essentially, it's because they're single-payer systems. Essentially, because they're non-transparent. Essentially, because there is no private market competing with the government programs. I don't want to affect Medicaid. But there are going to be battles about Medicaid and Medicare that's fought in the U.S. Congress domestically or in the state legislatures. That's a different issue. But we are not trying to backdoor price issues through trade agreements. And if you need clear statements of that from people, and I believe that from talking to USTR, that I think they will verify this, we never asked them to do that either. So we were a bit taken aback that there was so much concern by state governments that this was somehow some sort of a clever strategy, as if something like that could work, and that you can approve by the U.S. Congress to somehow control Medicaid and Medicare prices. Just not the case. And if we need to reassure people on that, we're happy to do that. I think that's an area where we actually can agree. In fact, I'll just leave it at that. I think that the issue of, I do take the Professor Baker's point about the issue of arbitrage. That indeed is a problem. It's a problem between countries, which is something that came up in the WHO, has come up in WHO discussions. Is a bigger problem I can imagine within countries. I don't know that it's insoluble. I think one of the things we wanted to talk about is how can you address those issues in such a way that to prevent arbitrage. I do think it's a significant problem. It's a significant problem. It can be a significant obstacle for companies who may want to do, they actually want to reach down to more people in the population. The other thing I would just say about markets in these countries is there are markets. I mean, the governments in every country in the world can set, including our own, our government, because it less sets prices or can set prices, and most of them do, or have rules of price controls. So when you talk about, you know, what would a profit maximizer do and what demand curve are they facing, they're not facing the demand curve, they're facing the Minister of Health sitting across the table saying, if you want access to this market, this is the price you're going to sell at. The amount of influence and leverage you have does depend to some extent on how much competition you're facing within patents, between patents. That's true. But it's not the case that, that there is, generally speaking, a free market, or that they're, you know, especially in the developed countries. I think that I'll just leave it there. I mean, there's a lot more that we could all probably say about away.
So let us now open up for wider conversation. Maybe I'll take three questions, three at a time. So Mary, Rudy, and Josh, and then so we'll take three, and then we'll have responses, and then take three more and see how long we go. Mary?
Thanks, Sean. My name is Mary Jennings. I'm from the American Medical Student Association, so that means I'm a medical student who's taking a year away from medical school to run AMSA's national office with a few other colleagues. Pfizer has popped up at a number of events that we've held recently. I was up in Boston earlier this year for a rally where the students were calling for, along with their professors, for the reduction of conflict of interest in medical education. And some of the Pfizer folks from Boston showed up to that rally. It's nice to see you, Jim. Yes. I wanted to make a point from the perspective of a future provider of healthcare, someone who is very interested in public health and very interested in comprehensive healthcare reform and what Senator Baucus has to say about healthcare reform. This point does not address U.S. production or distribution, but I would like to say that most new medications are, and someone touched on this earlier, most new medications are developed with public funding, actually. Or most kind of new innovative drugs are not developed with private pharma money. Those are often, repeat drugs or Me Too drugs that you might have, you know, that we see coming through the pipeline. AMSA is known for, you know, our Pharma Free campaign, which is focused on improving the quality of medical education. And it's not about getting pharmaceuticals out of the medical system at all, but it's about really protecting and preserving the integrity of the patient-physician relationship. So that's why I'm here today, because this really impacts that relationship. The one thing that I hope that you, Professor, would bring to your discussions of how to reduce the cost of our healthcare system, how to engage in cost saving around pharmaceuticals, and also to how to incentivize innovations, would be the point that we're missing here, and that's that pharmaceuticals spend a lot of money on direct-to-provider marketing, actually at least double what is spent on research and development. And we're not really touching on that here at all today. And, we, from AMSA, would argue that there is actually no place for marketing of pharmaceuticals to providers or even to, you know, to patients. That it's something that encourages the system to move away from an evidence base, and is something that really increases the price of medications and takes money that we could be using on research and development out of those systems. And so I just kind of invite you to bring that up in your discussions with Congress and with your discussions tomorrow, and would welcome any response.
We're gonna break in about 10 minutes, so I'm gonna ask people if they can be somewhat brief.
Thank you. I have two questions. They both relate to paragraph 3 in the letter to Senator Waters. The first one, I think Professor Baker gave you the benefit of the doubt when he said, thank you. When we said that, pointed to the provision in the letter that said about lower prices and for the poorer segments of the countries and who would set the lower prices. And I think he was driving at the point that the cost structure of generics manufacturers are lower than the cost structures of originator companies, and therefore shouldn't the, if you really want to bring low prices, shouldn't you open that up to competition by generic manufacturers? And I didn't hear a response to that point. I thought it was a perceptive point that deserves an answer. The other point that I would like to make is the sentence that says, paragraph 3 starts by saying, middle income nations would protect IP. But they are protecting IP. They have accepted the TRIPS agreement. But the TRIPS agreement also has certain freedoms and latitudes and flexibilities in order to protect national interest. And it is a government's national responsibility to take care of those who can't take care of themselves when it comes to medicines and affording, making medicines affordable, personally. So I think that's a bit of a spin that is not really reflective of the situation. And I think what we have to recognize is that the whole kerfuffle that we are having about compulsory licenses in order to safeguard essential national interests in developing countries comes from the fact that the TRIPS regime was forced on developing countries before they were ready for it. It was adopted, they were required to adopt standards that the developed countries only reached at a much later stage of their development and their productive capacity. So I think it's demonstrated what we need to do, in other words, I think, is to get away from the West imposing on developing countries when they have to do certain things and adopt certain standards. It is the internal market of developing countries that will indicate when they are ready for it. That is why India had such a hard time when it had to reform its patent law in order to comply with TRIPS, because there are competing factions in India. There are pharmaceutical companies that clearly want to protect the IP that they are creating, and that was an organic process, and they came out with a balance that was hopefully right for them. And that is the more natural way it should go if we're going to respect countries' autonomy and government's responsibility.
Thank you again for coming. I'll try to be really brief. I want to follow up where you ended up, which is the focus on public investment, and ask you to say a little bit more about your concerns with push mechanisms rather than the pull mechanisms of reimbursement through the pricing system on the R&D direction, and in particular whether you see distinctions there between the funding of the scientific research versus funding of clinical costs, which are much larger expenditures, and whether there are some ways to rethink how we're going to fund clinicals, or whether there might be differentiation between how you think of pushing pull mechanisms at least.
We're going to add just one. We have one question. I think this will be our only round one from the webcast.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, we have some people online that submitted questions, and I think just because of time, we're only going to get to read one. This one comes from Kevin Harrison from Boston University. He asks, in December 2004, the U.S. Department of Commerce under George Bush estimated that pharmaceutical R&D free riding by the richest 11 OECD countries totaled only $5 to $11 billion per year, which would have put it at under $1 billion per country under that methodology. And if this estimate is correct, why not address this issue with mechanisms that don't require another round or another global trade negotiation?
Well, I'm sure there's a lot of opinions on that gentleman's mind, but it's a fair point. I mean, I actually, John talked eloquently about some of it. It was actually his idea in the letter, actually, to talk about WTO around, but actually, it was a WTO issue at one point, and fortunately, it was the last round that was actually completed. I'm not sure that is the most efficient way of dealing with a problem like that. And it is only a small group of countries. WTO has obviously over 100 members or something like that right now. So they may not, and I think John sort of acknowledged that. And viewed in the terms that we're looking at today, $1 to $5 billion seems like a small change. Maybe it is a fairly easy problem to solve. I'm just being facetious, but I do think that the problem is that you've got slowing economies, aging populations, and all these developed countries with enormous pressure on cost control. And the question is how are you going to balance that on healthcare? How are you going to balance that? The desire to ensure that the engine, the incentives to work through innovation continue. I'll just briefly. I think the point was made that there are a lot of good, very efficient generic companies in places like India that can make products much more cheaply than big pharma in the U.S. And that's generally the case. I mean, even in the U.S., once our patent expires, business generally goes to generic suppliers in the U.S. Interestingly, those U.S. generic suppliers have very little foreign share abroad. It's an interesting question as to why that is. It's because markets are protected from it, which is why it's a trade issue. For not just the innovative industry, but the generic industry, that's a whole other discussion. But their issue. The reason that the costs are lower is obvious. They don't spend money on research. So, of course, they can make it trade less costs. I don't think that you're saying that we shouldn't have a patent system at all. We have a patent system, we can find the cost of research over a period of time, and then the company that can make the drug at the biggest scale, cheapest price generally, will get market share. But it is interesting how the market share is distributed globally and what the general prices are abroad. Let me just mention, will I have the floor or not? I swear I'll give it up a minute ago. When I say that we support competitive markets abroad, it's truly the case. And it would be, I'll just mention the region of the world I know best, which is East Asia, China, Korea, Southeast Asia, Vietnam, Philippines, Thailand. None of those markets is prescribing and dispensing separate. Hospitals and doctors make most of their money from prescribing drugs. They buy the cheapest drug, and there's a government reimbursement price. They'll mark that price up to the price of the reimbursement drug. The money is going into their pockets and not into the pockets of people who should be getting the drugs cheap. In addition, the average number of scripts in a place like Taiwan or China is only 4 or 5 per doctor visit. So there's a lot of cheap drugs being dispensed, and doctors, that's how they make their income. They make very much money from doctor visits in those countries. The generic market is not competitive. It's incredibly distorted. What you need in those countries is more. Again, as a Westerner, maybe I should be saying this, we need more of a Western system where prescribing and dispensing is separated and where you don't have the conflict of interest where a doctor is prescribing drugs simply on the basis of where he makes the most money. That's the reality for about 2 or 3 billion people in the world. And that's one of the reasons, by the way, why Big Pharma, which supposedly has all this power and influence, is losing market share in China right now. Because doctors and hospitals are not prescribing our medicines because they make a lower profit. And they're not looking at clinical efficacy, clinical where they can make the most money, because they have to. It's their only source of income. There's a lot to discuss here. That's all I'm saying. These are complex issues. And to say that simply suspending IP in China is the solution to that, you don't know anything about what the Chinese market looks like, for say. So that's all I'm going to say.
Okay, I'll just add a couple of quick points. First of all, the question of marketing expenditures by the industry. Obviously, I'm not the expert here on that. It is a very difficult one. I would assume that industry is not misreading its incentives when it sends as much as market demand does. And that means that if we're not happy with that, we have to change the way we buy goods. And I think no. And I think that change is probably happening to a significant extent with the rise of pharmaceutical benefit managers, or whatever they're called this week, with the increased role of large purchasers such as Kaiser and so forth, and Medicaid. I think that's an issue, but I have found that hasn't gone far enough that industry feels it can give up on its detailed people at this point. So at this point, I think we're facing a changing world, which we need to be thinking about wisely. I have no trouble with generics versus differential pricing by a single company. I think you can achieve that either way. And I think what we meant by the phrase middle-income combinations will protect IP was that at least for a chunk of the market would be IP-based prices. I would say, are we deciding things for other countries? I guess, let me sort of be politically incorrect. It seems to me that as a citizen of the world, seeing a lot of people screwed by lack of access to medical care, I have the right to make some suggestions. These won't get implemented without all kinds, zillions of steps, involving steps in the nations involved. But I think that is just as much a question of human rights as is whether or not freedom of speech is being denied in a particular country. And I think it is fair to put forward proposals that you think might help people in another country that effectively amount to suggestions, government, you do something. I think that's a fair thing to do and an appropriate thing in today's world. Finally, the push mechanisms. Obviously, that has to be central for many kinds of diseases. At the same time, it is an enormously difficult issue. We talk about what the last number is, but the cost for pharma getting a drug is about $1 billion. We've now invested at least $2 billion of public money in trying to get an HIV vaccine. And if we get, we are at a point where there could possibly be on the market for at least another 5 to 10 years. This is something which is essential. What I find most interesting about it is what Marion Moran found at London School of Economics in her studies, which are that the public-private partnerships are heavily linked with the pharmaceutical industry and the jobs, how to make that link work. I'm also intrigued because I don't really know quite why it is, but the public-private partnerships tend to be funded more by Gates and Rockefeller and so forth than by the federal government, and I don't quite understand why that is.
I do want to say something on the sort of China bashing takes place. As far as I know, China hasn't issued a compulsory license on any drug, and they were considering doing this in 2003, and enormous pressure was brought to bear by the European Commission and by the U.S. government, and they decided not to do it, and as a consequence, treatment for triple therapy for AIDS patients is pretty limited in China. And so there's basically the success of the trade efforts is really a lot of dead Chinese AIDS patients right now. So that's part of the Chinese bashing story. Now I think it's appropriate to say China's a big country, they have a lot of money. Other countries are India is rising. What should countries have to do? And for several years, there's been a bunch of NGOs have been saying that we should move toward negotiations on an R&D treaty. There should be basically a recognition that there has to be more contributions. And part of it is push funding. Part of it is, it's not all about what Pfizer does. It could be what Mark does. It could be NIH. It could be various things. The U.S. is by far and away on the public sector research way out there compared to other countries, much more so than they are in the private expenditures. And we probably have 90% of the public sector research right now in the world. And there's a lot of free-riding things about dealing with global public health break, including antibiotics, including vaccine development, things like that. And the WHO has agreed and made a move ahead of this. They have a discussion about an R&D treaty. And your idea is basically perceived as a way of trivializing and undermining this enormous achievement to get the WHO to agree to have a conversation about an R&D treaty. And it is really a competing approach. And that's something, you know, that's why there's a lot of all this pushback.
I don't want to necessarily have a final word, but I do want to say one thing about China. I wasn't bashing China. I'm just saying there's some, I think nobody will disagree that there are some significant structural problems with their healthcare system. With respect to the AIDS drugs and compulsory licensing, China has $1 trillion in foreign exchange reserves. If China wants to pay for AIDS drugs at any price, if it's high a priority, it can do it. So, I mean, I don't know who to lay the blame, whose feet to lay the blame, but China is not Botswana.
So I think we're going to end it there. I think this event went marvelously well. Thank you all for attending again on extremely short notice, and thank you for both Joe and John for coming and taking time out of your very busy schedules to stop off on here on a planned trip. Thank you.